Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to Philosophy in Action. I'm Greg Perkins, here with philosopher Dr. Diana Shea, where we answer your questions, applying rational principles to the challenges of real life. For those listening to the podcast, please join us live, where there's a text chat to chime in with your follow-up questions and witty comments. The show airs Sunday at 8 a.m. Pacific, 9 a.m. Mountain, 10 a.m. Central, and 11 a.m. Eastern Time at philosophyinaction.com. At the site, you can also submit and vote on questions for upcoming shows and browse the archives from past shows. Now, with all of that out of the way, let's jump over to the star of the show, Dr. Diana Shea.
Okay, happy Sunday.
Happy Sunday. Greg, you still need to record us a new intro now that you're...
I was just thinking, I was like, that's totally the wrong name. My voice works now.
Now that your cold is done, you get to... It needs to be on your agenda for this week.
It's still a little raspy, but that might be good for the recording.
Yeah. You'll sound a little bit badass.
Raspy.
Yeah.
Sure.
Well, so
Something like that. Welcome,
everyone. Greg, tell us what topics we have on tap this week.
Okay. We have a great set of questions on morality versus prudence, concealing a relationship from parents, death notifications via Facebook, and more.
So, folks, if you're listening live, you can post questions and comments in the text chat that's over at philosophyinaction.com/live.
All right. So what's been going on this week?
Well, so I came back from my trip to San Francisco, which was super awesome. It was definitely a much needed break for me. And I've been getting back to work. So all business as usual again this week, except for the fact that as we were just talking about, I bought a weight rack and bar and plates and so on off of Craigslist. And I'm super excited because I'm doing deadlifts and so on. So feeling a little bit extra badass this week.
Picking up heavy things is good.
Yes. Yeah.
All right. Well, if nothing else, we can jump in.
Yes, let's jump in.
Morality versus prudence. In ethics, should moral actions be differentiated from prudential actions? I often hear academic philosophers say that a person should clearly distinguish prescriptive actions that are prudential from those that are moral. For example, if I want to bake a cake properly, I have to follow a certain set of procedures. However, whether I bake the cake or not, or whether I follow the recipe competently or not, has no bearing on my moral standing. Generally, prudential actions are considered actions that would benefit me and not harm others. By contrast, I hear it said that whether my action is moral or immoral is determined by whether it harms others. In moral philosophy, is it valid to separate that which is prudential from that which is moral, and to do so in that way?
Yeah, this is a good question. And what I want to do is start off by clarifying terms, and then we're going to talk about the history of this concept. Then we're going to talk about its modern usage, and then we're going to talk about how I think it ought to be used. Okay, so first to clarify terms. Dictionary definition of prudence is, quote, acting with or showing care and thought for the future. And basically, it's often used as a kind of synonym for somebody who has good judgment about real-world practical matters, particularly for somebody who has concern for the long-range effects of what they're doing. And colloquially, prudence is often associated with caution, but that's not the sense in question here, and that's actually one of the problems, is that prudence has been married to caution in a way that actually is not morally clarifying.
Okay. So how does this distinction operate in academic philosophy then?
Yeah, so the concept of prudence has this really long history. And in Aristotle, it goes back before him, but this virtue of, it's called phronesis is the Greek term. The virtue of phronesis is sometimes translated as prudence, but more often than not now, it's translated as practical wisdom so as to disassociate it from this baggage of caution that the common term prudence has come to mean. Now, practical wisdom is hugely, hugely important for Aristotle. It's crucial for the exercise of any other virtue because it enables a person to find the virtuous mean between extremes. Meaning, like, don't get hung up here on his theory of the mean. Instead, what it means is that, like, look, when we're making ethical decisions, we have to learn to choose well, given all the many complicating contextual factors that the virtuous person has to consider. Like, they have to know what's relevant and what's not and how much weight to give certain things and to really see a whole situation, take that all in and make the right choice, make that sensitive, like sensitive to context kind of choice. And So that's what practical wisdom does, is enable us to do that. Now, this kind of practical wisdom, it's not something that you can learn from books or from lectures. It's a kind of inductive art, so it requires years, if not decades, of really working hard at this process of moral deliberation, preferably with the guidance of others. Now, for Aristotle, he's going to say that means older and wiser teachers, but in my experience, that's actually not necessary. What you need is the guidance and the help of other thoughtful people who might be your same age or even might be a bit younger than you, who are also working really hard on this task of living well. And at least in my experience, personality differences and differences in strengths and weaknesses help us get to this point of practical wisdom, even if that person doesn't have overall greater practical wisdom than I do. Now, in this process of learning practical wisdom, you're going to make lots of mistakes. You're not going to be hitting the mean every time. You're not going to be doing the contextually sensitive thing every single time. But the key is to learn from those mistakes and do better next time, rather than making the same mistake over and over again, which is honestly what most people actually do in their lives. I mean, I've seen this so often with people who aren't really concerned to do well, to do right, that they just keep making the same goddamn mistake again and again and again. That's what they do. But if you do, if you're not doing that, if instead you're trying to make these inductions and figure out like what really matters in my moral deliberations, then you can get closer and closer to perfection, closer and closer to doing it right from the outset. And again, this kind of practical wisdom, this requires induction, lots and lots of induction, lots and lots of just experience. Now, in my view, this concept of practical wisdom, this idea of practical wisdom, is a huge aspect of rationality. And I actually think it's so important that it might be worth identifying as a distinctive virtue in the way that the objectivist ethics breaks out honesty and justice and productiveness and pride and so on as aspects of rationality. I certainly wish that there was a greater emphasis in this, in Ayn Rand's ethics, particularly because without it, there's this tendency for people to moralize based on rationalistic deductions from their ethical principles. And that's exactly what we see in far too many objectivists. I wish that there was a greater appreciation for the importance of this, the importance for like working on figuring out what the right thing to do is, what this super contextually sensitive thing to do is on a day-to-day basis, as opposed to, well, look, here's the right thing to do, and that's that, and anybody who doesn't do it that way, well, they're just wrong, and end of story.
This is interesting. We didn't talk about this in the prep meeting, and what you're calling to mind is, Rand didn't say, well, seven's a magic number, and I'm going to come up with seven virtues that we must talk about. Instead, many of the virtues are identifying things and calling them out because they just happen to be tough for humans. Integrity. Sometimes we've noticed that humans have a hard time actually acting on what they know. So we have a virtue for that. So this could be in that category where humans, we've noticed, have a tendency to rationalize and be rationalistic and not do things this other way. So it might be worth calling out.
Huh. Yeah. Yeah.
What would you? I won't delve further because you probably want to talk about this question, but got my attention
on
that one.
I think this would be a great. Somebody could certainly submit a follow-up question on this, ask me to talk more about what this means, and give some examples of this and so on, and examples of how it matters in life. So, because this is one of the things that I feel like I'm getting a greater appreciation of now with all the personal life changes that I'm undergoing or inflicting upon myself, however you want to see it, where it's not like my principles have been wrong, and it's not like even my application has been particularly bad in any way, shape, or form. But there's just this like deeper understanding that I have now about details, some of the more contextual details, and noticing things and things that really matter, and that. Like I'm now trying to be super duper sensitive to that, and I think I'm making much better choices as a result of that.
Yeah, more data to work with.
Yes.
Okay, so back to the question: what about this in contemporary academic ethics?
Yeah, I think there's this tendency. For one, if you're going to talk about prudence or practical wisdom, generally that's people in ancient ethics talking about it in part, or at least there's definitely this background of that. But there is also this tendency to contrast moral with prudential actions. And I don't think the question quite has it right, although people tend to use this distinction fairly loosely. But moral actions in general are good for others. Prudential actions are good for the self. And it tends to be this fairly sharp divide. So moral actions might be prudential, but purely prudential actions are not moral. They're not worthy of moral credit.
Yeah. And these, from the start, just struck me as terrible categories. Is this because philosophers are conflating altruism with ethics generally as a frozen abstraction?
Yes, absolutely. So a frozen abstraction is when somebody takes a particular instance of a concept or a subcategory of the concept and treats that as equivalent to the whole concept. And here, what we see...
I was going to throw in a little quick example. That would be conflating facial tissues with Kleenex.
Mm-hmm.
And saying, hey, it's not a facial tissue if it's not Kleenex. That's what we're talking about, right? Kleenexes?
Right.
It's like, no, facial tissue is a broader category. Same thing for morality. It's not just altruism. There's lots of other ways, too.
Yeah.
Other
and
brands.
I do. It's a funny memory that I have. I remember as a kid being upset when my parents bought some other brand of Q-tips other than Q-tips.
What the hell are these?
That was a kind of frozen abstraction, right?
We do it with the Coke. Often the category leaders become conflated with the thing. Coke
right.
is a soda.
But it's only, but that's
are...
a, like, that's a purely verbal thing. It's only a frozen abstraction
yeah.
if when you're like, wait, that's not a soda. Soda means Coke. That doesn't mean Pepsi. Right?
So,
the point here is too many philosophers think that ethics means altruistic ethics or sacrificial ethics or, I actually think that it's impartialist ethics for a reason I'll say in a minute here. But basically, the problem here is that ethics isn't just about how you treat other people. It does concern the fundamental principles by which you live your life, including when you're completely alone. And that's why ancient ethics, we also consider those to be ethical systems, even though like they're about, particularly Aristotle, is ultimately about the flourishing of the organism, the well-being of the human person, not fundamentally about how you treat other people. That's in there, but it's a secondary or derivative kind of concern. And so philosophers tend to like, they don't know how to deal with this thinking about Aristotle's ethics sometimes because like, it's just not about treating other people and there's other stuff in there and they get all pretzled over that.
It's like, oh, egoism. You don't talk about egoism, but we wanted to talk about morality.
Right.
Yeah.
And I will say like modern ethics. So particularly, which means the derivatives of Kant and John Stuart Mill, so utilitarianism and deontology, they're deeply altruistic, or rather what they are is impartialist, meaning that in thinking about what I should do, my interests shouldn't matter to me any more than other people's interests should matter to me. So I should be impartial about whose interests I give priority. So just the fact that like, so here you're in pain, I'm in pain, I shouldn't be prioritizing my pain and say, taking care of that as a first priority, simply because it's my pain. That would be being partial. That would be being biased. You know, just because it's me doesn't mean my pain is more important than anybody else's. So that's an impartialist ethics. And like, for reasons that obviously I could say a whole lot more about that is actually wrong. I mean, in particularly the way egoism views things, and I think this is correct, is that each person should be the center of his or her own moral universe. Each person should prioritize his or her own self because that's the life that you're actually having to lead. That's the consciousness that you are is you. And so like, what are you thinking that everybody's on a par, everybody's equal? Like you're in that head of yours, like you're in a position to do something about that life. So that should be your top priority.
Yeah. To me, it's just, it seems so goofy. It was like, okay, you got one job, live your life. And now you're not managing your own life. You're worrying about everything other than that. No.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Seems goofy. Okay. So, how should we think about this distinction then between moral and prudential actions? Does it make sense in the context of an egoistic ethic?
Yeah, to some degree, but just not in this way that contemporary academic philosophy is going to cash it out. Not in this way of like actions that are about other people versus actions that are about the self. So moral principles are really high level abstractions. They're universalizable. They apply to most of life's situations. So things like, look, a person ought not sacrifice others to himself or sacrifice himself to others. that's this like really high level abstraction about how to live your life. Or that a person ought not fake reality. That's the virtue of honesty. Again, it's this like really high level abstraction that, although you don't have to, once you automatize it, you don't have to be thinking about it all the time. In fact, this is something that's guiding every moment of your day. Now, so that's what our moral principles are. But there's plenty of normative principles. In other words, principles that tell us, here's what you ought to do, or if you want to do X, then you should do Y, that are much more limited in scope. Often those are guiding particular activities, like in the question, this is the cake making, right? But we, you know, just some examples here, right? Drivers should yield to pedestrians. This is a normative principle, but it's not an ethical principle. Or sailors should know about weather patterns. Or writers should use the Oxford comma. Right? I feel very passionate about that last one. Like really, yeah. Really passionate. I think that's really important. But nonetheless, it's not a moral principle. So that's one category of things that are moral principles, but they're not, or sorry, they're normative principles, but they're not moral principles. There's also another category of things that's a bit more vague, where the advice is kind of moral in nature, but it's more on the order of a guideline or a heuristic than a clear, contextually absolute principle like what we see in ethics. So for example, suppose that you discover a friend has told you a serious lie, something really important. I might say to you, I might give this general advice of, look, it might be unwise to continue this friendship. But I'm not giving you some kind of ironclad rule, like don't fake reality, right? Like you don't want to fake reality in continuing the friendship. You can draw upon those moral principles, but there's this kind of mid-level, intermediate principle that says, you know, like beware of people who've lied to you, right? You might want to add some distance. Yeah. You might not want to have that kind of relationship.
What we often call a red flag. It's a red right. flag. You really ought to watch that.
Right, right. But the right decision here, the reason it's not an ironclad rule is that the right decision here depends on a lot of particular circumstances. Why the person lied, what their view of the lie is now, what they've told you about it, all those kinds of things, right? And so this is why, Greg, you and I on the show will often say things like, well, look, we don't think this is immoral, but this seems unwise. Right, like that's what we're getting at in a way. It's like this is kind of it's not a clear-cut moral issue, but there's kind of a heuristic here, you know, like you need to deliberate hard before you choose this path. Here be beasties and other dangers over here in this uncharted territory, and those kinds of things I think fall under the category of prudential concerns, because it's like, dude, you don't want to hurt yourself, you don't want to frustrate your values, you know. Make sure you're not imperiling things that matter to you by doing this. So that's, I think that counts as normative principles that are not moral principles. Now, the other thing that's important to note here is that in an egoistic ethics like that of Ayn Rand, like the objectivist ethics, the moral is the practical. And here I'm going to use practical as synonymous with prudential. So the moral is the practical. The purpose of morality is to teach people how to be happy and to live well. This includes being in harmony with other people as much as possible. The purpose of morality is not to demand that you suffer and sacrifice yourself for the sake of others. So as a result of this, what the purpose of morality is, every moral action is also a practical or prudential action. And in a certain sense, every practical action is a moral action because it's one that's going to serve your life and happiness. So there's not this hard and fast distinction here. There's not, well, there's moral actions on the one hand and prudential actions on the other. No, it's basically what's practical and what's moral are really two sides of the same life-serving coin. And it's a question, does this draw upon known moral principles or not? So I think so long as you keep that broader context in mind, it's fine to distinguish between, like here, these are moral principles that we have, and here are prudential principles that we have. And to say, look, on the level of principles, we can distinguish between moral and prudential. You know, we can distinguish between what's universal and high-level abstraction and applies to most of life situations versus the normative stuff that doesn't. But there's not going to be any such distinction on the level of actions, though. Every action should be both moral and prudential. And if it's not moral, then it's not prudential. And if it's not prudential, then it's not moral.
Indeed.
I hope that makes sense. Does that make sense to you, Greg?
Well, let's see. Yes.
Moral this actions is a bit different than what we had.
Looking at whether it would be good to give a little summary, you know, kind of go around it one more time here. So, yeah, if you're considering the kind of principle that's driving you, you can say, yeah, it's a moral principle, and that it's one of those really fundamental ones. Or it could be some other normative principle or even a rule of thumb that's driving you. And in that case, you might say, well, this is prudential. It's practical.
Right.
But at the same time, it's not that it's not moral. It's, you should have already looked around and screened it as like, well, this is not obviously going to cause any problems in the super long term, the really deep fundamental moral principle. But what's actually guiding me is this not so deep, not so broad principle. And then yeah, in just casual talk, I'll call those things practical, but right. They're also, and they're normative.
Right.
They're just not a deep moral principle. They're still moral because it's still living my life. I hope that does make sense. There is a good chance that people misunderstand. Follow-up questions, folks.
Yes.
Okay, what's the take-home point?
So the way that moral actions are distinguished from prudential actions in contemporary academic philosophy is fraught with all kinds of problems, particularly due to assumptions of altruism. But we can learn a whole lot from Aristotle's concept of practical wisdom, and a distinction between moral and prudential principles is valid.
Indeed. I think they're just overwhelmed and still processing.
We have a small audience in the
yeah.
chat. Hopefully,
and they're having a battle over the Oxford comma right now.
Yes. No, actually, I think everybody agrees.
Oh,
Trey
yeah.
says, you know who doesn't use the serial comma? People with the death premise. I would agree with that. Yeah.
Yeah.
Unfortunately, that includes Ayn Rand. It's she didn't use the serial comma.
I understand, really, in
the age of newspaper writing, I understand. Like, those commas, they add up. But there's mm-hmm. no excuse these days in the age of the internet for not using an Oxford.
The bits are pretty close to free, folks. We can yes. disambiguate. It's okay. All right. With nothing else there, it's time for the reminder about the tip jar.
So Philosophy in Action Radio, not just the live show, but the podcast too, is available to anyone free of charge. That's because we want to spread rational principles far and wide, and we do that with every show to thousands of listeners. But we can't accomplish that alone. We do rely on the support of our fans. So if you value our work, please do contribute to our tip jar. You can visit philosophyinaction.com/support to send money online or via the mail. We suggest $5 per episode or $20 per month, but any amount is welcome. You can also create a recurring monthly tip via PayPal, Dwolla, or your bank's bill pay. Then you don't need to remember, and you also get free access to Philosophy in Action's premium content, and we really appreciate that regular support. That makes a huge difference to me. So again, you can do all that at philosophyinaction.com/support.
Concealing a relationship from parents. Is it wrong to conceal information from my father while I live in his home? I am a 21-year-old gay college student still living with my parents as I pay down my tuition and progress through college. Both of my parents know I'm gay. My mom is completely fine with it. It's a sore subject with my dad and something we don't discuss. He threatened to kick me out of the house when I came out, but then recanted because I think he's wrestling with the morality of the issue. 2 months ago, I started dating a really wonderful guy. He comes over often and sometimes spends the night. My mom knows we are together. She is happy for me and approves of my relationship. I haven't told my dad for fear of being kicked out. My dad specifically told me that he, quote, did not want that kind of activity in his home, unquote. I understand that this is his house, as well as my mom's, who doesn't have a problem with my sexuality, and I try to keep things low-key whenever my boyfriend comes over. I also try to spend as much time with him away from my home as possible, but sometimes I would just like to sit down in the comfort of my own room and watch a movie with him. I think my dad would kick me out if he ever thought that there was anything going on between me and this guy he knows only as my friend. Am I obliged to tell him about our relationship? Doing so may result in me having to couch hop until I find a suitable dwelling. It may also make it impossible for me to continue paying my own tuition, a thing I'm quite proud to be able to do. Living at home helps cut a lot of expenses to make that possible. But is it immoral to lie to my dad about my relationship? I am planning to move out after my bills for the semester are paid, and I can save up enough money to afford the down payment on an apartment or house. I will not be keeping my relationship a secret from anyone after that. But until then, do you think it's immoral to continue lying? I do not understand or sympathize with my dad's aversion to my sexuality. He's told me once before that no one else can know because it would bring embarrassment to him. I think that's second-handed and irrational. My sexuality has no bearing on anyone but me. Still, I feel like I have to lie to protect my own interests.
Yeah, this is a good question. Because, you know, like, you're not a minor anymore, but you know, like there's these issues about living in your parents' house and doing things that they disapprove of, even if for irrational reasons. So I've got three major points to make here. First of all, if your dad doesn't know that the male friend of his gay son, who sometimes spends the night, is the boyfriend of his gay son, that's because he doesn't want to know. That's because
yeah,
he's
la, 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 la.
Yeah. Uh-huh. Yeah, yeah. You've told him all that he needs to know to figure it out, and he could always ask if he were unsure, if he actually wanted to know the facts. So, yeah. So it's not like you're hiding anything from him in that respect. Secondly, I think it's okay to just say he's your friend. This is true. Not telling your dad explicitly about the fact that you have sex with this person isn't lying or being dishonest. Being discreet about your sex or dating life is not being dishonest, even when you're living in this in your parents' home, right? I think it can feel dishonest. It really can. I understand that. And it can actually become dishonest very quickly if your dad asks and you say, oh, no, we're not involved. We're just friends. Like, yeah, then you're lying, right? But it's not dishonest just to not be talking about your sex life with your dad. Go ahead, Greg.
I'm sorry, and it's just like you. If he probes for some reason, if he leaves that la 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 don't want to know mode, you can just tell him. It's like, hey, you said you didn't want to talk about this, so I'm not talking about this, right?
Right. Now I am really glad that you're actually concerned about this issue, and I don't know. Like, it's not clear. Have you actually explicitly lied to him? I hope not. But I do think that your concern about this shows that you have this honesty that will serve you well in life. But I think it's really important to remember you are entitled to your privacy, particularly on an important personal matter that he's hostile to due to his own biases. You have no moral obligation to expose yourself to his unwanted immoral disgust for homosexuality and to cause a rift and get yourself kicked out of the house because he's irrational on this issue of that's a private matter to you, right? So again, I hope that there hasn't been any dishonesty. And assuming that there hasn't been, I just like don't think that merely not telling him is dishonest. Okay, so third, you are living in your parents' house, and you do need to respect that. Parents they really oftentimes have really ridiculous rules for their adult children about sex in the house, and this is not just about homosexuality at all. I mean, like Greg, you and I, at least for our parents, they would
we
put
both have
straight
the same
couples,
thing.
Yeah, straight yeah. couples who are living together in separate rooms when they're visiting. You two cannot sleep in the same bed, right? That was the norm that I grew up with. Greg, that was the same for you.
It happened, and I just describe it as like, well, they have an intrinsicist rule of if you're not married, you don't sleep together.
Right.
And in their house, they enforce that. And well, back home, we live together. Of course, we sleep in the same bed.
Right. And it's funny, like parents will have that rule even when they're not, they don't think that people should wait for marriage to have sex. So
yeah.
Like,
it's just the
it's
polite
a,
society
yeah,
rule or something. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. So that's completely
it's a dumb
wrong,
rule.
But it is their house. And so that's something that you ought to respect, even if it's irrational. So given what your father said about not wanting, quote unquote, that kind of activity in his home, I'd strongly recommend not having sex in any form in your father's house. Now, the complication here is that your mom knows, and apparently she doesn't mind, and it's her freaking house too, right? But what you, so I don't think there's not a moral concern here per se, but what there is more of a prudential concern. You do not want to get yourself thrown out suddenly after a big blow up with your dad over this. And if you can say, like, look, Dad, he's my boyfriend, but we're not, like, you told us you didn't want that in your house, and so we're not doing that in your house, I think that's okay. So I think there's no problem to have him over to cuddle while watching a movie, but lay off the sexual activity while in your father's house. I think that reduces the complications, that reduces the likelihood that you are going to get suddenly thrown out, which would be
there's a lot of other places in the world you can go do that stuff, and it leaves you in a nice position. You never have to be dishonest with him. If he brings it up, you can say, look, you told us you didn't want that stuff in your house. Straight face, I'm not doing that.
Right.
And we're good, right?
Right. So my basic view here is, look, you don't have an obligation to tell your father about the relationship. You are entitled to your privacy, but you should respect his wishes in terms of, you know, keeping that out of the house. I also think that it might be better for you to tell him in a controlled fashion rather than for him to come upon you two kissing or something like that, right? But again, this is not a matter of morality. It's not like you'd be doing wrong by just acting, you know, being boyfriends and not talking to him about it. But it might be the wiser thing to do to tell him in a controlled fashion.
Indeed. Now, you got an update from the questioner, right?
Yeah, so he I think posted a comment or messaged me. He said, regarding the question you put on tap, I ended up telling my dad about a month after submitting it. Everything went all right, and I'll be moving out just as soon as I can sign a lease on an apartment. So things are going well for me and my boyfriend. We've been together nearly a year now, close quote. So that's like super awesome. Good job. Thumbs up. I'm actually surprised that it went so well. Like, maybe dad is coming around. So that's, I'm really happy to hear that.
Excellent. Okay, what's the take-home point?
So you don't have an obligation to tell your father about the nature of your relationship with your boyfriend. You are entitled to your privacy, but while you're living there, I do think you should respect the rules of the house.
Sounds good. All right, we have a little bit of follow-up here. Trey asks, but is he violating his dad's property rights by gay sexing in his dad's house? So if he did that, would he be violating his dad's property rights, Trey?
You know, I wouldn't think of it as a rights issue.
That's not the right level, I don't
think.
Yeah,
it's just like it's impolite, it's disrespectful.
Bad manners.
It's disrespectful of the fact that it is his house. So I guess there is a property rights issue underlying that. And certainly, like, if dad comes to visit you, you can gay sex all you want. Not in front of him, that would be rude.
Yeah.
But like in your bedroom, and he wouldn't, it doesn't matter if he doesn't approve, right? It's your freaking house. But it's not, I don't know, it's not a property rights issue per se. It's just you're in his space. Be kind about that.
The owner of the property gets to, has the say on, what's allowed with their property. And so that's why he gets to say, I don't want that kind of thing in this house. But if you don't do it, yeah, that's why he can say that. I categorize it as bad manners.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah.
Even though it's, ultimately it comes from that. So
it's bad manners, and it's explosive in this way.
Yeah.
The bad shoes. That's
the problem. Terrible manners. Yeah. Okay, so why don't you remind listeners about your premium podcast on moral perfection?
Yeah, so back in 2012, I gave a lecture entitled Should You Try to Be Morally Perfect as part of the Think series of public lectures that are hosted by the CU Boulder Philosophy Department. In my lecture, I explored and defended Ayn Rand's concept of moral perfection, arguing that it's necessary for a happy, fulfilled moral life. That lecture is now available as a premium podcast. You can preview the first 14 minutes of the lecture over at philosophyinaction.com/perfection. Then you can purchase access to the full 90-minute podcast for $10. But if you're a regular contributor to Philosophy in Action's tip jar, it's free to you, so you just need to email me for your free access. The one thing I want to mention here is that the lecture is a nice, friendly introduction to some of the principles of Ayn Rand's egoistic ethics for people who are unfamiliar with that. But it also has plenty of fresh red meat for longtime objectivists, too. And so I do think that folks listening will find it quite interesting, both in theory and valuable in practice. And so you can listen to the preview and purchase it over at philosophyinaction.com/perfection.
Death notifications via Facebook. Am I wrong to be upset that I learned of my uncle's death via Facebook? My uncle recently died. We weren't close, but I would have expected a phone call from my parents about it. Instead, I learned about his death via a Facebook status update from one of my cousins, not his child, but his niece. I've been really angry that I learned such momentous news that way, but I'm having trouble explaining why to my family. Am I wrong to be upset? If I should be upset, what's wrong with what happened? What should I say to my parents now?
Yeah, so of course it's okay to be upset here, even if you weren't terribly close. I would say, look, it's okay to be upset, even if you're wrong about that. Like, accept your upsetness and then try to figure it out. It's okay. But I think there's a genuine reason for you to be upset here. First of all, this was a family member, and parents or somebody else in the family should have informed everyone in that family circle before making some kind of public announcement. And the same is true when it's not family, but the person is just in the community. Other people who are in that community who knew the person who actually had some kind of relationship with him should be told about major things before the whole damn world knows.
Yeah, it definitely makes sense that you feel bad. You're not feeling respected and visible.
Yeah, and I just think in general, social and family connections are important parts of life. We do prioritize people in our sort of social and family circles over random strangers as we ought to. And one of the ways that we do that, one of the ways that we show that is by communicating important news slowly. So in other words, to ever wider circles of importance. And that's how we communicate to people, like, you matter, you're part of this family circle, is that you hear the news first. And when people fail to do that, when people are just treat everybody as if they're the same as random strangers, people can feel unimportant, they can feel alienated, as it seems like the questioner did here.
And this is a direct reflection of that distance that we talk about. When you're evaluating people's character and importance to you, you set them at a certain distance. Well, this is one of the effects of that distance. You're this close to me. You get to hear this before those people and after those.
Right.
And getting a signal here. And that's what is making you feel bad here, is that you were just sent the signal that you were at a different distance than you thought you were.
Right. We see that particularly with pregnancy announcements, because there's people who you tell, like, right away, like the moment their pregnancy test comes back positive. And then there's people that you tell, like, once you hit that 3-month mark where it's less likely that you're going to be miscarrying and so on. And people have different strategies for that. And that's fine based on what their own personal preferences are for as to how open they are with other people. But there is this sense of, like, yeah, there's a controlled release of information here. And that's important.
Indeed. Okay. So should this person do anything about it now?
Yeah. I think if your family consists of semi-reasonable people, which hopefully it does, I think you should calmly explain to your parents that you really wish that you had been notified by some kind of private communication. Explain that the public announcement, learning about it on Facebook, it made you feel like an outsider. It made you feel no more important than a random stranger. You can ask for better communication in future. I think the critical thing is to do that in a calm and kind way without any kind of recriminations, because maybe the circumstances of your parents or other family members were way more difficult than you realized. Maybe they were going to try to notify family when that damn cousin posted the news to Facebook really before they ought to, and they're all super mad at her. Or maybe they were just overwhelmed with grief and they couldn't make those phone calls. It was just so difficult for them. Or maybe they thought that somebody else was supposed to contact you, and so there was a kind of miscommunication there. Basically, if you know what happened, then and it was something like that, then yeah, your feelings of alienation and unimportance, those might be assuaged. Hopefully they will be. And if not, if it wasn't something like that, if they were just like, yeah, we didn't think you were important enough for that, then yeah, maybe you need to add some distance to those family relationships. Maybe you need to adjust your expectations of them downward.
Yeah, hopefully if not, they would, the moment you say it, they would be like, oh gosh, we didn't think about that. That's so sorry. You are more important to us. We didn't mean to tell you that. Okay, good stuff. What is the take-home point?
So you have every right to feel upset about the way that this news was communicated to you. You should have a calm and kind conversation with your parents to tell them how you feel, listen to what happened, and ask for better communication in future.
Okay. Doesn't look like we have any follow-up, so moving on. It's rapid-fire question time. We're going to be asking Diana questions from this long and growing queue in any old order I like. Not a lot of prep. Interesting things could happen. So with that, okay, this is a nice one to start with. This person says that they love listening to your podcast, but alas, it's only once a week. Yeah, it's just once a week. Are there any other podcasts that you enjoy or can recommend?
Definitely recommend Dan Carlin's Hardcore History. I've listened to a bunch of those. They're fabulous. They're really, really high quality history podcast. I haven't listened to them, but I'd also recommend the History of Rome series. And there's some others that same guy has done that Paul has really, really enjoyed. I just, like, Paul really likes Roman history, and I'm just like, okay, maybe a little bit, but I can't do the detailed stuff. So I haven't listened to those, but if you're interested in that, those are apparently really, really phenomenal. Manager Tools and Career Tools podcast by the Manager Tools guys. Those are phenomenal too. So if you're interested in business and personal development in that way. And I don't know, maybe some other people in the chat can have some recommendations. Trey, I know that you listen to lots and lots of podcasts, so you might have some advice. Oh, Radiolab. I've really liked a lot of the This American Life episodes. So, you know, go look and for one, go look and see what's popular, and you're likely to find some good stuff in there. Okay, so Trey also mentions 99% Invisible, Memory Palace, Invisibilia, The Mystery Show. Waiting for him to type more, reply all. Greg, do you have any others that you would add?
Oh, no. you guys feel a lot better on this than I do.
You know, I listen to podcasts periodically. So, you know, I go through phases where I listen to tons and tons of podcasts, and then I don't listen to any for a while, and then I listen to a bunch and so on.
Trey continues to...
Yeah.
What's
so
funny
all the Gimlet and about... Grammar Girl are the two others that he recommends.
There you go. This is Trey's doing really well because he left on this. We're about 30 seconds ahead of him. He's hearing us from 30 seconds ago,
right.
And so we're reading him a little bit delayed. He's really turning him out.
Yes.
Okay, so moving on. This is a little interesting. If rights are freedom to pursue values and a want can be proved to be a disvalue, why does one have the right to keep the product of the want? E.g., the purchase of a yacht solely for social status.
Because it makes no sense. It makes no sense to say, I believe this is essentially the Catholic doctrine. Like, you have no right to do wrong. So you have only the right to do the morally correct thing, right? That's not having rights at all. That's having
that's
somebody dictate
right
to you
idea.
What you ought to do. Having rights means that you have a choice to make. You get to decide what's actually best for you. And that somebody can't say, well, look, these are the five things that we've decided are morally acceptable and everything else is out.
Yeah.
I mean, this is how you behave like an adult. This is how you are your own person, is by having the right to make mistakes. And how is it that you're ever going to learn the idiocy of purchasing a yacht solely for social status? If that's something you're inclined to do, the way you figure out that that's a bad choice is by actually doing it. And then suffering the consequences of that. So this idea that by limiting people's exercise of their rights, by forcing them to do the right thing, you're making them moral people, that's not true. You are just forcing them to outwardly obey certain precepts of your own moral code, and they are learning not a damn thing. And it is likely that you are going to be actually making people more, like, very, very seriously immoral in deep and really terrible kinds of ways.
As I like to say, the purpose of rights is not to make you, is not to deliver the true and the good. That's not the purpose of rights. The purpose of rights is to create the context where you can pursue the true and the good. It's not a guarantee. It's like the... And in a really concrete way, like the right to free speech. You shouldn't expect everybody to say just wonderful things. You should expect people to say horrible, untrue, nasty things too. That's what the right is for. But that also leaves room for people to speak the truth and the good things.
Right. Right.
All right. So
can we add a few more podcasts here since Trey?
Oh yeah, go for it. Tim Ferriss.
He says that's hit or miss. He recommends Missed in History as a more bite-sized history podcast. I actually like that thought. I've written that one down for myself. Tom Hall recommends the Yaron Brooks Show and the Objectivism Seminar, which is yours. So I think you should have thought of that one, Greg.
Oh, well, I don't even think of it as a podcast. It's just a weekly thing.
Yeah.
Good point.
It is.
We do have hundreds. We have a lot of people that listen to that. It's a fun little crowd.
Yeah. So Tom has asked Trey to post that somewhere. So Trey, maybe you could post that, just post it to Facebook. And that way, if you post it as a public post, I just threw my pen.
Yeah.
If you post it to Facebook as a public post, then everybody can take a look at that.
Yeah, I will get the plug in then. Go to objectivismseminar.com and you can listen to hundreds and hundreds of episodes with our merry band of created individuals. Okay.
Astute commenters is what you meant to say.
Astute commenters, yes. And
What are you reading actually, now, actually, in the Objectivism seminar?
Oh, we are reading Binswanger's book on epistemology.
Oh,
and
right.
The way that goes is we have a lot of practical application and grinding through details. We're going at a rate of about 5 pages per session.
Oh, God, that's going to take forever.
It is. It's crazy. Less detail-oriented books, they tend to go a lot faster. But
right. This
kind, OPAR was the same. But if you look in the podcast history, you'll see a lot of good material. So, moving on, if ideas are open-ended and a philosophy is made of ideas, shouldn't every philosophy be open-ended?
No. So, I've written about this topic fairly extensively, and folks who are interested in that should shoot me an email and I will send you the, I'll send you the relevant links. Just because ideas are open-ended, like philosophy, the discipline is open-ended. In other words, there's always new truths to be discovered and so on. But there's a point to defining philosophical systems and to talking about like, here's Kantianism, not understood broadly as the movement that follows him, but like, here's Kant's actual philosophy. Here are the things that Bentham actually believed. Here's the things that Ayn Rand actually advocated. That's what objectivism is. So, and there's a difference between that and schools of thought, where there's a bunch of people sort of working together and they have similar ideas and they're all sort of evolving and playing off of each other. And that's certainly more open-ended, but even those have sort of beginning points and end points in a way. It's important for us to be able to talk about not just here's what's true in philosophy, here's what this person thought. Because we're going to be comparing them and we want to know, here's the facts of the matter. And so certainly my approach to philosophy these days is I'm going to take what I want and leave the rest out of any philosophical system. But this is true of objectivism too, which has certainly been my major philosophical influence. And I don't have to, like, I don't care about whether I'm an objectivist or not. It just does not matter to me one iota at all. And I think it's actually somewhat harmful to think in terms of like, well, I'm an objectivist, because then your identity gets wrapped up in believing these things that honestly you might question if your identity wasn't wrapped up in being an objectivist and being part of that objectivist community. But on the one hand, like, I'm taking what I want and leaving the rest, but I'm also recognizing, like, this is what the actual philosophy says. And I think that's really important to say, look, I'm going to be honest. I'm not going to claim that the philosophy said X just because I believe that's true when it really said Y. I'm just going to say, look, I have a disagreement here. And that's that.
Yeah. I figure it'll work itself out.
Yeah.
So philosophy itself, of course, is open-ended, but philosophies do have identity. They are something. It's like, well,
right,
this person thought these things. And so you want to be clear about that.
Mm-hmm.
Whether or not you are one of those, though, I guess that is just an effect. It's secondary. With all of the fun we've had with this, as far as I know, we're both objectivists because we agree with those fundamental principles. But there's so many other things we think.
I don't know. Actually, I mean, maybe some people will be surprised by this. Maybe not. I don't know. I don't know whether I count as an objectivist anymore. I've got at least some borderline case issues. Things about disagreements about sense of life and so on. And mostly I just don't care. I just don't care. It's just not like, and I've stopped calling myself an objectivist because I don't wish to be associated with all the crazy sauce that's out there. Particularly the official crazy.
I do go through phases of that. When I see something really bad, it's just like, oh, I don't want that name now. I don't want people to
not, for me, like, I'm not concerned to study objectivism anymore. Like, I feel like I spent a lot of years doing that, and I know the philosophy quite well. And there's sometimes where I need to go look up something as a reference because I'm not clear about it. But I don't, like, I'm done with that. So it's like, it's not my intellectual focus anymore. I'm much more interested in learning new things, learning, you know, other ideas from elsewhere, and figuring out how to incorporate those into my worldview. So that's the other reason why, like, just that label, it doesn't make sense anymore, because that philosophy isn't my focus anymore.
Yeah. Okay. Speaking of philosophy, this person asks, I feel an obligation to check out the original works of other philosophic schools, but I'm not at all interested in them. I'm not at all interested in them. Why would I feel that way? And should I do that?
Yes, I think it's good to do that. There's a couple of reasons. First of all, if and this is one of the problems in the amongst objectivists, if you just like if your first encounter with philosophy is just reading the objectivist works, things can seem the conclusions that are drawn there can seem really obvious and really true to you simply because you don't understand the complexity of the issues. And so, yeah, if you want to understand what like how difficult the problem of induction is, or like what actual views have been about concept formation and the relationship, say, between definitions and concepts or words and concepts or whatever it is, if you're just reading Introduction to Objectivist Epistemology, you are not able to make an informed decision about that. You just can't. You don't have the context requisite for saying I'm certain about this. You could say this seems plausible to me, but it's all I've read. So, yeah, you know, I don't know. It seems good enough. That's all you can say. Secondly, most secondary sources are complete crap. So I highly recommend actually reading primary sources. So that's the other reason to read actual original sources. But it's, you know, there's Christians who read only Christian sources. And when you talk to them, you realize that they have this really skewed view about what the alternative viewpoints are. Right? They think, for example, that it's between, you know, godless socialist atheism and religious American capitalism. And you're like, dude, you have this issue framed all wrong. Right? And it's because those are the sources, those are the only sources that they're reading. And so as a result, their whole view is skewed. They don't understand what the options are. They don't understand why other views would be plausible. If you're only reading sources that are on quote unquote your side, you need to understand how little you know.
That's a really nice analogy, because I've watched in various topics, religionists argue other things like origins, like about evolution and creation. It is a very skewed view. It's very narrow. They've been sort of channeled into patterns of thinking, and they have no idea they've been manipulated.
Right.
It's not good. All right, moving on. Hey, is it a valid role of government to establish a national flag and a national anthem?
This is a bizarre kind of question. Like, of all the things we should worry about in a free society, do we have a national anthem and a national flag? Like, I don't think there's any harm in that. I think that flags are useful. There's actually military uses for flags, for one. So yes, there needs to be a flag. A national anthem, I think you could go either way. Like, you could have the government say, this is the thing that we play at government events. You guys might want to know it. Anybody else can use it or not.
We need one for the Olympics.
Right. But like, that could be the private Olympic committee settles on that or something like that. I mean, yeah. Like, I would love to get to the point where this is the major topic of national debate, because we have, like, everything else has been solved. We've rolled back the welfare state. There's no more regulations. Taxes are voluntary. And now we're going to debate, should we have a national anthem? That's what I want.
Yeah.
That's what I want.
Is it proper to have, you know, state birds and things like that? It's like, this seems like harmless fun to me. It's like, fine.
Yeah. I mean, so long as it's not costing anybody money.
Yeah.
You know, honestly, like, legislators can do far worse. Yeah, that's what I was about to say. They can do far worse than being like, let's have a debate about, you know, whether the turkey or the bald eagle should be our national bird. That's okay. I'm willing to let them occupy themselves with those really tough questions.
Interesting. Here's another kind of goofy one. Is elective plastic surgery moral?
Yes.
Well, you're changing God's handiwork. I don't know what I'm thinking.
Yeah, I don't see. I mean, there's. It's not that you can say all elective plastic surgery is moral. People can do it. They can make bad choices. For one, they can. I mean, we periodically hear stories about like somebody who had a bunch of like motor oil injected into their rear end because they wanted a big ass. No, don't do that. Right.
Real distortion.
Go see a actual physician, a plastic surgeon, do your due diligence, like all those kinds of things. But also make sure that your motivations for doing this are reasonable. If there's some aspect of yourself that's always really bugged you and you have the money to fix it, like, why not? Why not? Again, this is not like you have an obligation to stay with the face that God made you. God made you with. Because God didn't make you. Your parents did it. And honestly, they might have kind of fucked up.
We all do body hacks at all levels and all types.
Right.
There are tattoos and piercings and weight loss and weight gain and blah, working out. And this is another body hack as far as I'm concerned.
Right.
And it does take me back to kind of a standard line we have. Concrete actions are not themselves per se moral or immoral for the most part. Usually
right.
they're not.
Like genocide.
There's nothing determinant.
Genocide, I can say, like, yes, don't ever do that. But
yeah, that's immoral. I'll give you that. But most day-to-day actions, concrete actions, you can't just say immoral or moral. You've got to know why. Why
right.
is someone doing it?
Right.
All right. So now another person asks, is win or lose competition in sports and academics good for children?
I think it depends. When kids are particularly young, when they don't even understand like what they're doing with the game, then that's kind of dumb. And it can be undue pressure. And certainly if one can have more cooperative games and so on, that can be, or just like skill-based, or just like we're not keeping track of the score, those kinds of things are all good. I'm trying to think of...
So there's a subtext here of, look, reality is not zero-sum.
Right.
Are we going to damage our kids by putting them in zero-sum
And also, I do think that competition, it can encourage a fixed mindset rather than a growth mindset. And so that's a that's a problem. I actually recently played, when I was in San Francisco, we played Pandemic, which is a cooperative game. And I've never actually played a cooperative game before. And so like you're playing, everybody is taking turns and you're playing against the game. So you're trying to prevent global pandemic. And so there's a lot of coordination and so on. And we ended up losing by a quarter of a turn. Like if we had had a quarter of a turn more, we could have actually won. And instead the universe went like blueing. And it was so funny because Arthur and I were paired up, and he was so passionate about it. And so I posted this to YouTube, this like 2-second video of him going, rah, like, cause he was so angry. He was so frustrated by that. It was really fun. It was such a good time. And that was really interesting. Like I like that model. It was more interesting than I would have thought. And so it would be nice to have more options of that kind, both for adults and children.
Okay. I guess for somebody with a growth mindset, it's amusing. It's fun. It's like playing poker.
Test the skills or something. Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. With playing poker, it's, I know that it's artificial, and that's part of what can make it fun because it's goofy.
Right.
I don't deal in normal life in that way. Just like in poker, I don't go around misleading people. But in poker, that's part of the fun. I get to put on this other role, and I know we're having fun doing this. So I don't know. I guess I can see where if the child has been raised with kind of a growth mindset, you can sprinkle in these zero sum things as like, look, this is deliberate and goofy, and that's why we're having fun with it.
Right. I find it really hard, even on things where I feel like I've got a pretty well-established growth mindset. I find it competition brings out my fixed mindset. And so that's just something I have to be wary of. And so I think it's something that's really worth paying close attention to and talking to your kids about and asking of yourself if you're competing and so on.
Okay. Let's see.
I think we're done. Like, I think we can conclude here unless you have one more that you really want to do.
Nope.
By the time we're done, we'll be done.
Final one.
Yeah.
Okay. With that said, then, it's time for us to sign off from another episode of Philosophy in Action Radio. Thanks for listening. We hope you all had a great time.
I had a fantastic time. Once again, thank you to our generous contributors. With every episode of Philosophy in Action Radio, we bring you ideas that engage the mind and help you live better. Plus, we introduce thousands of other listeners to the principles they need to live virtuous, happy, and free lives. We think that's hugely important, and we do depend on your support. So if you want to contribute, just go to philosophyinaction.com/support.
Remember, we welcome feedback on what we're doing well and what we could do better too. Just email all the criticism to diana@philosophyinaction.com.
I do know the mood meter is still broken, and I'm hoping to get to that this week. I was just like, screw it, I'm taking off last week. So that's what.
And if you send her something particularly, you know, awesome, either way, she passes it on to us.
Oh, yeah.
Great.
Oh, yeah. Of course I do. If you do want to see what's on tap for the next few weeks, you can visit philosophyinaction.com/upcoming.
I'm Greg Perkins, and you can find me online at objectivismseminar.com. This show features Dr. Diana Brickle, and you can read her blog Noodle Food at philosophyinaction.com/blog. Please drop by to submit and vote on questions for upcoming shows, and then join us live here at the same time next week at philosophyinaction.com.
Thanks, everyone. Bye.